Today is Monday, November 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coronavirus cases around the world are on the upswing. California went under curfew to curb its spread. Will it be enough?
I'm not sure how effective it's going to be as a standalone policy.
But in Britain, the restrictions put in place are to be rolled back.
The government also will increase mass testing in an effort to suppress the virus until vaccines can be rolled out.
And can streaming services save Hollywood blockbusters? We'll have these stories and more next. Collectively, around the world, the globe has seen nearly 58.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, according to statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University in the United States. The U.S. has just over 12.1 million cases, India a little over 9 million, and Brazil just over 6. While nearly 1.4 million deaths have been attributed to the novel coronavirus, there have also been just shy of 37.5 million recoveries. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said that he plans to end a nationwide lockdown as scheduled on the 2nd of December and will announce a return to regional restrictions. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley leads us off.
Johnson's office also confirmed plans to begin a nationwide COVID-19 vaccination program next month, assuming regulators approve a vaccine against the virus. The government also will increase mass testing in an effort to suppress the virus until vaccines can be rolled out. Johnson's office says that the government plans to return to using a three-tiered system of localized restrictions in England, with areas facing different lockdown measures based on the severity of their outbreaks. Sarah Shackley, London.
Most residents in the western U.S. state of California are under a nighttime curfew that began on Saturday as surging coronavirus cases threaten to swamp the healthcare system. New restrictions require people to stay home from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. unless they are responding to an emergency, shopping for groceries, picking up takeout, or walking their dogs. The month-long curfew covers 41 counties that contain most of the state's population and is designed to reduce the spread of transmission, although some county sheriffs are saying that they will not enforce the order. Now, to get a better idea of how the curfew may curb the spread of the novel coronavirus, I spoke with Dr. Runjan Misra, an internal medicine physician practicing in San Francisco.
I'm not sure how effective it's going to be as a standalone policy, because like you said, most people are usually indoors, but perhaps he's trying to just make sure that the bars and other restaurants maybe that were open late, they will not have a chance to be open that late anymore. And perhaps those individuals that were socializing during those hours, maybe the younger generation, won't have the ability to congregate in areas and socialize to maybe decrease the spread that way.
Is that going to be enough? Because during the pandemic, the mantra has been, wear a mask, stay physically distant, wash your hands. And for a large number of the population, they have complied with those instructions. There have been others who have resisted such. And as the pandemic has continued, there's the pandemic fatigue phenomenon. So with the forthcoming vaccine and these other recommendations, is this going to be enough to put the pandemic behind us?
You know, there are many really good models that we've been following, which project how many potential lives could be saved if we implement certain mandates like staying 6 feet apart, wearing masks, washing hands, not socializing. And those models have accurately portrayed that single-handedly we could save hundreds of thousands of lives moving forward in the next coming few months if we just mask. Now, while we wait for a vaccine to come up and other potential treatments for COVID, we need to remember that there is a single most important way that we can stop this, you know, this infection from spreading so that we can not have this insane surge where we are running out of healthcare options for individuals who really need them. And that number one way is to mask.
One last question. Healthcare professionals were warning of a possible twindemic, the confluence of the coronavirus pandemic along with the seasonal influenza virus. We're entering the winter months now. What are you seeing as a healthcare practitioner? Is that a possibility?
So I'll give you some good news, Steve. We usually follow the Southern Hemisphere and the trends, because obviously winter comes sooner there. So we see their trends for the flu. And actually, it's been very, very mild in the Southern Hemisphere this year. So we're hoping, following those trends, that that same kind of pattern is going to replicate here. And in addition, if people mask, then they're not going to be passing around the common cold or influenza. So we're not only going to be protected from coronavirus transmission, but also from all these other viruses that are part of the, you know, the cold season. What we are seeing right now in clinics is not a lot of flu cases. That's really good. Now, the one thing that I would recommend for people is, while we're waiting for the coronavirus vaccine to come out, make sure you get your flu vaccine, because that can at least protect you from the flu. If you do get the flu, your symptoms are very mild. And if, God forbid, you end up in the hospital, we will know exactly what to treat you for. Okay, so we won't be confused between, oh, whether this person has the flu or the coronavirus, because symptoms do overlap and they're very similar. And if you do get the flu vaccine, you can potentially open up a bed for a person who's actually really sick with coronavirus and who needs hospitalization.
Dr. Runjan Misra practices in San Francisco, California. The World Health Organization says the antiviral drug remdesivir is not beneficial and should not be used in treating patients hospitalized with COVID-19. Lisa Schlein has that update.
A WHO panel of international experts who reviewed the results of clinical trials have concluded there currently is no evidence that remdesivir improves survival of COVID-19 patients, no matter how severely ill they are. Head of clinical care at the World Health Organization, Janet Diaz, says the panel conditionally recommends against the use of remdesivir in hospitalized COVID-19 patients, regardless of the severity of their illness. The panel says the evidence shows the drug has possibly no effect on mortality.
Now, this did not prove that remdesivir does not have a benefit at all, and that's why it's a conditional recommendation. There can still be potential small benefit, maybe in a subgroup, which is why the panel also recommended continued trials, continued enrollment into clinical trials.
Diaz suggests it might perhaps be better to focus on subgroups, such as severe patients versus critical patients, in future clinical trials. The WHO panel's recommendation is based on new evidence, which compared the effects of several drug treatments for COVID-19. It includes data from four international randomized trials involving more than 7,000 patients hospitalized for COVID-19. Bram Rochweg is a practicing ICU doctor in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and co-chair of the WHO panel. He tells VOA there's still ongoing uncertainty about the impact of remdesivir on survivability and mortality.
We're not saying that there's evidence that remdesivir doesn't work, but there's evidence, there's not good evidence that it does work. And there's not good evidence that harm is off the table. And so it was these considerations that the panel looked at, and they felt that the majority of people would not ascribe to a new therapy when the benefit was not there, and that there was still a potential for worsening outcomes and leading to increasing death.
In the meantime, the WHO panel notes alternative treatments exist that are cheap and widely available, such as corticosteroid dexamethasone, which have been shown to reduce death among severely ill COVID-19 patients. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The shopping holiday known as Black Friday has been postponed for a week in France, as major retailers have accepted the government's request for a delay to help small shop owners still closed because of the pandemic. Nicolas Pinault has that story.
With more than $7 billion in sales last year, Black Friday has become a major event in France and a good deal for customers ahead of Christmas. But this year is different, and once again COVID-19 takes the blame for it. Non-essential small shops, such as those not selling food, are currently closed under health restriction in the country. Therefore, they have been struggling, and the competition from the supermarkets or online retailers is considered unfair. French Economy Minister Bruno Le Maire called this week for a one-week delay for Black Friday to ensure the reopening of small stores under maximum safety conditions.
Et donc je voudrais appeler.
Le Maire says he demanded all economic key players, like supermarkets and online retailers, to be responsible. He wonders if November 27th is really a good day to organize a Black Friday. It does not make sense currently to organize such event. Surprisingly to many, Auchan, Carrefour, the main supermarket chains in the country, accepted the offer. Even the giant online retailer Amazon agreed to the measure. Facing huge backlash in France for increasing their sales by between 40 and 50% while small businesses remain closed, the U.S. technology company said it would postpone its sales event for a week. Frédéric Duval is the CEO of Amazon France. He says Amazon is paying attention to society and authorities, and as a consensus with other big retailers, they decided to postpone Black Friday until December 4th to enable small shop owners to open before December 1st. It is for the common interest, he insisted. Experts are skeptical on the announcement, as Black Friday is now a worldwide reality, and technically, authorities cannot prevent French customers from purchasing products on November 27th on foreign websites. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
VOA has ongoing and expanded coverage of the pandemic at our website. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden plans to name the first members of his cabinet on Tuesday. That's according to a key aide on Sunday, even as President Donald Trump urged on Republicans to help him in his long-shot legal effort to overturn his re-election defeat. Following a hand recount of ballots, officials in Georgia certified U.S. presidential election results in the state, confirming that President-elect Joe Biden defeated President Donald Trump. Pennsylvania, another battleground state during the election, is slated to certify its election results in the coming days. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikaswara has the latest.
Despite supporters of President Donald Trump storming into the state capitol in Atlanta earlier this week, demanding investigation on claims of election fraud, on Friday, officials reaffirmed that Joe Biden has won the state of Georgia, following the largest hand recount of ballots in American history. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger.
The numbers reflect the verdict of the people, not a decision by the Secretary of State's office or of courts or of either campaigns.
Meanwhile, the Trump campaign continues to claim the election was plagued by fraudulent voting.
That could have been Mickey Mouse. That could have been a dead person.
A claim repeated by the president, who on Friday added another accusation that pharmaceutical companies delayed announcing COVID-19 vaccine findings until after the election, a claim the companies have denied.
We had Big Pharma against us. We had the media against us. We had Big Tech against us. We had a lot of dishonesty against us.
Vanessa Beasley teaches presidential rhetoric at Vanderbilt University.
His strategy is consistent with his strategy all 4 years of governing. If he doesn't say it, then it can't be true. So just like we had fake news, now we're having obviously fake elections and trying to cast doubt on that institution just as he did the media.
Trump's legal team has failed to provide evidence of ballot fraud, a fact the Biden campaign is eager to point out. Bob Bauer from the Biden campaign legal team.
The Trump campaign and their allies have now lost a staggering 28 lawsuits in the 17 days since Election Day.
The Trump campaign has been floating the idea that Republican-controlled state legislators should dismiss Biden's victory in their states and assign electors that will vote for Trump instead. The move is unlikely to succeed, but damage to the perceived legitimacy of the election may already be done. William Howell is a professor in American politics at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy.
The outcome of these efforts not so much will be that we're going to observe Trump being listening to, you know, Trump's second inaugural on January 20th, but rather that we're going to have tens of millions of Americans who are convinced that Biden cheated his way and that our politics are, to their core, rotten, which will yield a country that's all but ungovernable.
In a Morning Consult poll conducted in late October, 70% of Republicans said election results will be reliable. In mid-November, this number dropped to 27%. 45% of Republicans say Trump should concede eventually unless he can back up fraud claims. And 27% say he should not concede no matter what. Patsy Wittikaswara, VOA News.
And coming up later...
You know, it's a Band-Aid for COVID right now, but...
I think overall in the long term, everyone's going to have to get used to this new world.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The U.S. National Science Foundation says that the iconic radio telescope at the Arecibo Observatory will be decommissioned. The distinctive instrument features a 305-meter deep-dish receiver that's suspended by cables over a jungle in Puerto Rico. According to the online movie database IMDb, films like Contact with Jodie Foster and the James Bond movie GoldenEye include footage of the legendary telescope. The radio telescope has been online for 57 years and has endured numerous hurricanes and earthquakes. However, in August, after one of the telescope's support cables detached, an evaluation was conducted to determine whether to repair or demolish it. The study showed that repairs could not be done safely and recommended the instrument be demolished. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Ethiopia's military is warning civilians in the besieged Tigray regional capital that there will be no mercy if they don't save themselves ahead of a final offensive to flesh out the defiant regional leaders. It's a threat Human Rights Watch says could violate international law. An army spokesman says that from now on, the fighting will be a tank battle, and asserts that the army is marching on the Tigray capital and will encircle it with tanks. Ethiopia's prime minister is giving the Tigray leaders 72 hours to surrender, saying that you're at the point of no return. A two-day virtual G20 summit hosted by Saudi Arabia got underway Saturday, with many of the top world leaders attending it virtually, including U.S. President Donald Trump. On Sunday, the group of 20 vowed to spare no effort and making a COVID-19 vaccine widely available to all populations. Edward Uranian has more on the summit.
This year's G20 summit officially began Saturday as Saudi King Salman spoke of the various key issues facing the international community in the wake of the global COVID-19 pandemic. He says it is our duty to build a better future for our peoples and move toward vaccines and treatments for COVID-19 in a timely fashion. The king said G20 nations must continue to support the world economy, including trade and the movement of people. He said all must give the young a chance for a better job with a solid education. The aging King Salman stumbled through several of his remarks, but gave a mostly lucid presentation. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the king's heir apparent, was seated nearby and watched impassively as the king spoke. Other world leaders could be seen on the screen in the king's office as the virtual meeting progressed. Russian President Putin, whose speech was not carried live on Saudi TV, was reported by Saudi media to have called for a coronavirus vaccine available to all. Putin also stressed that the virus has upset the world economy, causing an unprecedented crisis that created famine in parts of the world, as well as an increase in unemployment and poverty, which are the biggest threats to humanity today. In an unusual step, Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV broadcast British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's introductory comments in English.
This has been an unprecedented year, the greatest upheaval many of us will face in our lifetimes. Unfortunately, circumstances have meant that we couldn't meet in Saudi Arabia. As I said before, it's only by joining forces and working together that we will defeat coronavirus and build back better from this crisis.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's comments were distributed to Arab media with subtitles. He said decisions stemming from the summit would be decisive for minimizing the negative effects of COVID-19 for the world and in responding to the world's expectations. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, says the G20 originally began as a foreign ministers' conference and did not take on any real importance until the 2008 financial crisis. Now, he says, the summit appears to have evolved into something more significant.
Si on observe de près le sommet des G20 avec sa diversité, tout ça donne l'impression.
He points out that despite the G20 summit's lack of power to make formal decisions, it gives the impression it could eventually take on the role of a world governing body. He says the G20 has moral power, and this is the first time an Arab country has hosted the summit. Abu Diab adds that there were committees meeting on the sidelines to respond to the threats of the world, including vaccine distribution, helping poorer countries with the economic fallout of the virus, along with the unrelated issue of climate change. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Mortar shells have slammed into a residential area of the Afghan capital, killing 8 people hours before U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo held what are likely his last meetings with the Taliban and Afghan negotiators trying to hammer out a peace deal. The Saturday attack in Kabul, claimed by Islamic State militants, also injured 31 people. 2 Taliban officials told the Associated Press sides have found common ground to move forward on the stalled talks. The assault came as peace talks were underway in Qatar, where Pompeo told Afghan government negotiators that the United States will sit on the side and help where it can in the negotiations with the Taliban. On Friday, experts testified that the Trump administration's latest policy move, drawing down U.S. troops in Afghanistan, is a mistake. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has that part of the story.
After President Donald Trump replaced top civilian leaders at the Pentagon, Acting Secretary of Defense Chris Miller made a major announcement on Tuesday.
By January 15th, 2021, our forces, their size in Afghanistan, will be 2,500 troops.
The change cuts the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan by nearly half. And it means the U.S. will soon have its fewest troops there since the start of the war in 2001. But with peace talks ongoing, expert after expert warned lawmakers Friday that the move was throwing away America's most crucial bargaining chip. Stephen Biddle is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
In my view, the drawdown policy announced Tuesday was a mistake. What the administration announced on Tuesday is the slower, more expensive version of failure.
And Ryan Crocker is the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan.
We are getting nothing in response to that drawdown. That has been the problem with these talks from the beginning. By sitting down with the Taliban without the Afghan government in the room, they knew from the start that this is a negotiation on the terms of our surrender.
U.S. forces toppled the Afghan Taliban in 2001 following an invasion that had strong public support in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks carried out by al-Qaeda, whose leadership was being harbored by the Taliban. 19 years later, American public opinion has changed. President Trump won office in 2016, promising to withdraw from foreign conflicts. And Congressman Bradley Byrne says people in his district are tired of the war.
They think 19 years, thousands of American lives lost, all these injuries, all these hundreds of thousands of servicemen and women lives disrupted, obviously billions and billions and billions of dollars, you know, enough. They probably would support a continuing counterterrorism effort, okay? They don't want al-Qaeda to get back in control there.
But therein lies a contradiction, experts said, because unlike the Afghan government that fights al-Qaeda, the Taliban has shown no evidence that it will stop protecting the terror group. Seth Jones is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It's not just a counterterrorism issue. It is also a prevention of the overthrow of the government. And so what does 2,500 give us versus something closer to 4,500 or 5,000?
Absent a peace deal, the experts testified that the further withdrawal of American forces will likely shift the balance of power in the military campaign in favor of the Taliban, putting a potential peace deal even further from reach. And with coronavirus on the top of President-elect Joe Biden's priorities, It's unclear how his administration will handle any fallout from the move. Carla Babb, VOA News, Washington.
The Belarusian human rights group, Viasna, says more than 200 people have been arrested and many of them beaten by police during protests calling for the country's president to resign. The demonstrations that attracted thousands were the 16th consecutive Sunday of large protests against President Alexander Lukashenko. The Interior Ministry confirmed that there had been detentions, saying that those being held had been disturbing public order and resisting police officers, but did not give any numbers. Wonder Woman 1984 isn't skipping theaters or moving to 2021, but is altering its course. Warner Brothers announced this past Wednesday that the last big blockbuster holdout of 2020 is still opening in U.S. theaters on Christmas Day, but it will also be made available to HBO Max subscribers free of charge for the first month. The film will also debut in international theaters on December 16th. Now, this is an unprecedented strategy for a film of its size, but a sign of the extraordinary measures that many Hollywood studios have had to resort to in the COVID-19 era. Tyra M. Lindsay Warren is a marketing scholar at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, where she studies consumer behavior and attitudes, multicultural media and advertising, movies, and entertainment. I asked her if this shift can sustain the Hollywood movie-making machines that have seen box office returns decimated by the pandemic.
You know, it's a Band-Aid for COVID right now, but I think overall in the long term, everyone's going to have to get used to this new world and, a pivot strategy in terms of leveraging theaters and online and balancing everything out to make it all work together. I don't think it's either or. I really think it's an and, you know.
You mentioned that this is a Band-Aid and who knows what the way forward is going to be. During the pandemic, theater chains have had a really rough time. Many have actually closed, at least right now, because there are no new films being released. A lot of the big tentpoles or blockbuster films are being postponed at least until 2021. And with Wonder Woman 1984, it is going to be released overseas in the worldwide market in theaters. Does that mean that the studio is going to have to rely more on foreign box office receipts to try and fund their studios during the next year or so?
You know, I don't think so. I really think studios just have to stop being lazy. I say this all the time. I've said this, you know, for other interviews, that they don't adjust quickly enough. You know, just to give you an example, just looking at Wonder Woman 1984 and looking at the audience, right? It's women primarily. 51% of moviegoers are women, according to the 2018 MPAA report. 47% of ticket buyers are women, and 52% of women control the household income for their families. So they have to do a better job, meaning Hollywood has to do a better job marketing to women. Because even going back to the $821 million box office gross for the first Wonder Woman movie, the domestic gross was 50.2% and the international gross was 49.8% of that. So still, domestic is winning, and you can't just not have domestic and totally rely on international. But yet at the same time, Steve, what truly perplexes me in this COVID environment regarding, you know, movie theaters closing is why haven't they pivoted? You know, when you look at other businesses, from restaurants to whatever the case may be, all businesses have been adjusting in some kind of way, if they can, to try to stay afloat. I mean, honestly, for the long term, I think Hollywood has to figure out the right balance of all of their ancillary revenue streams, because, you know, like they say, no man or woman can live by bread alone. I don't think no Hollywood studio system can live by streaming alone, as they are now also finding out that they cannot live by movie theaters alone.
Tyra Lindsay Warren teaches at Baylor University, and you've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a magnificent Monday.